Part 2. Industry and Commerce. Chapter 5. The Rise and Fall of Businesses. Failure is part of the natural cycle of business. Companies are born, companies die, capitalism moves forward. Fortune Magazine. Ordinarily, we tend to think of businesses as simply money-making enterprises, but that can be very misleading in at least two ways. First of all, about one-third of all new businesses fail to survive for 2 years, and more than half fail to survive for 4 years, so obviously many businesses are losing money. Nor is it only new businesses that lose money. Businesses that have lasted for generations, sometimes more than a century, have eventually been forced by red ink on the bottom line to close down. More important, from the standpoint of economics, is not what money the business owner hopes to make or whether that hope is fulfilled, but how all this affects the use of scarce resources which have alternative uses, and therefore how it affects the economic well-being of millions of other people in the society at large. Adjusting to changes. The businesses we hear about, in the media and elsewhere, are usually those which have succeeded, and especially those which have succeeded on a grand scale. Microsoft, Toyota, Sony, Lloyd's of London, Credit Suisse. In an earlier era, Americans would have heard about the A&P grocery chain, once the largest retail chain in any field, anywhere in the world. Its 15,000 stores in 1929 were more than that of any other retailer in America. The fact that A&P has now shrunk to a minute fraction of its former size and is virtually unknown suggests that industry and commerce are not static things, but dynamic processes in which particular products, individual companies, and whole industries rise and fall as a result of relentless competition under ever-changing conditions. In just 1 year, between 2010 and 2011, 26 businesses dropped off the list of the Fortune 500 largest companies, including Radio Shack and Levi Strauss. Such processes of change have been going on for centuries and include changes in whole financial centers. From the 1780s to the 1830s, the financial center of the United States was Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, but for more than a century and a half since then, New York's Wall Street replaced Chestnut Street as the leading financial center in America, and later replaced the city of London as the financial center of the world. At the heart of all this is the role of profits and of losses. Each is equally important from the standpoint of forcing companies and industries to use scarce resources efficiently. Industry and commerce are not just a matter of routine management, with profits rolling in more or less automatically. Masses of ever-changing details within an ever-changing surrounding economic and social environment mean that the threat of losses hangs over even the biggest and most successful businesses. There is a reason why business executives usually work far longer hours than their employees, and why only 35% of new companies survive for 10 years. Only from the outside does it look easy. Just as companies rise and fall over time, so do profit rates, even more quickly. When the Wall Street Journal reported the profits of Sun Microsystems at the beginning of 2007, it noted that the company's profit was its first since mid-2005. When compact discs began rapidly replacing vinyl records back in the late 1980s, Japanese manufacturers of CD players thrived, according to the Far Eastern Economic Review. But within a few years, CD players only offered manufacturers razor-thin margins. This has been a common experience with many products in many industries. The companies which first introduce a product that consumers like may make large profits, but those very profits attract more investments into existing companies and encourage new companies to form, both of which add to output, driving down prices and profit margins through competition, as prices decline in response to supply and demand. Sometimes prices fall so low that profits turn to losses, forcing some firms into bankruptcy, until the industry's supply and demand balance at levels that are financially sustainable. Longer-run changes in the relative rankings of firms in an industry can be dramatic. For example, United States Steel was founded in 1901 as the largest steel producer in the world. It made the steel for the Panama Canal, the Empire State Building, and more than 150 million automobiles. Yet by 2011, U.S. Steel had fallen to 13th place in the industry, losing $53 million that year and $124 million the following year. Boeing, producer of the famous B-17 Flying Fortress bombers in World War II, and since then the largest producer of commercial airliners such as the 747, was in 1998 selling more than twice as many such aircraft as its nearest rival, the French firm Airbus. But in 2003, Airbus passed Boeing as the number one producer of commercial aircraft in the world and had a far larger number of back orders for planes to be delivered in the future. Yet Airbus, too, faltered, and in 2006, its top managers were fired for falling behind schedule in the development of new aircraft, while Boeing regained the lead in sales of planes. In short, although corporations may be thought of as big, impersonal, and inscrutable institutions, they are ultimately run by human beings who all differ from one another and who all have shortcomings and make mistakes, as happens with economic enterprises in every kind of economic system and in countries around the world. Companies superbly adapted to a given set of conditions can be left behind when those conditions change suddenly and their competitors are quicker to respond. Sometimes the changes are technological, as in the computer industry, and sometimes these changes are social or economic. Social changes. The A&P grocery chain was for decades a company superbly adapted to social and economic conditions in the United States. It was by far the leading grocery chain in the country, renowned for its high quality and low prices. During the 1920s, the A&P chain was making a phenomenal rate of profit on its investment, never less than 20% per year, about double the national average, and it continued to prosper on through the decades of the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. But all this began to change drastically in the 1970s, when A&P lost more than $50 million in one 52-week period. A few years later, it lost $157 million over the same span of time. Its decline had begun, and in the years that followed, many thousands of A&P stores were forced to close, as the chain shrank to become a mere shadow of its former self. A&P's fate, both when it prospered and when it lost out to rival grocery chains, illustrates the dynamic nature of a price-coordinated economy and the role of profits and losses. When A&P was prospering up through the 1950s, it did so by charging lower prices than competing grocery stores. It could do this because its exceptional efficiency kept its costs lower than those of most other grocery stores and chains, and the resulting lower prices attracted vast numbers of customers. Later, when A&P began to lose customers to other grocery chains, this was because these other chains now had lower costs than A&P and could therefore sell for lower prices. Changing conditions in the surrounding society brought this about, together with differences in the speed with which different companies spotted these changes, realized their implications, and adjusted accordingly. What were these changes? In the years following the end of World War II, suburbanization and the American public's rising prosperity gave huge supermarkets and shopping malls with vast parking lots decisive advantages over neighborhood stores, such as those of A&P, located along the streets in the central cities. As the ownership of automobiles, refrigerators, and freezers became far more widespread, this completely changed the economics of the grocery industry. The automobile, which made suburbanization possible, also made possible greater economies of scale for both customers and supermarkets. Shoppers could now buy far more groceries at one time than they could have carried home in their arms from an urban neighborhood store before the war. That was the crucial role of the automobile. Moreover, the far more widespread ownership of refrigerators and freezers now made it possible to stock up on perishable items like meat and dairy products. This led to fewer trips to grocery stores, with larger purchases each time. What this meant to the supermarket itself was a larger volume of sales at a given location, which could now draw customers and automobiles from miles around, whereas a neighborhood store in the central city was unlikely to draw customers on foot from 10 blocks away. High volume meant savings in delivery costs from the producers to the supermarket, as compared to the cost of delivering the same total amount of groceries in smaller individual lots to many scattered and smaller neighborhood stores, whose total sales would add up to what one supermarket sold. This also meant savings in the cost of selling within the supermarket, because it did not take as long to check out one customer buying $100 worth of groceries at a supermarket as it did to check out 10 customers buying $10 worth of groceries each at a neighborhood store. Because of these and other differences in the costs of doing business, supermarkets could be very profitable while charging prices lower than those in neighborhood stores that were struggling to survive. All this not only lowered the costs of delivering groceries to the consumer, it changed the relative economic advantages and disadvantages of different locations for stores. Some supermarket chains, such as Safeway, responded to these radically new conditions faster and better than A&P did. The A&P stores lingered in the central cities longer and also did not follow the shifts of population to California and other Sunbelt regions. A&P was also reluctant to sign long leases or pay high prices for new locations where the customers and their money were now moving. As a result, after years of being the lowest price major grocery chain, A&P suddenly found itself being undersold by rivals with even lower costs of doing business. Lower costs, reflected in lower prices, is what made A&P the world's leading retail chain in the first half of the 20th century. Similarly, lower costs, reflected in lower prices, is what enabled other supermarket chains to take A&P's customers away in the second half of the 20th century. While A&P succeeded in one era and failed in another, what is far more important is that the economy as a whole succeeded in both eras in getting its groceries at the lowest prices possible at the time, from whichever company happened to have the lowest prices. Such displacements of industry leaders continued in the early 21st century, when general merchandiser Walmart moved to the top of the grocery industry, with nearly double the number of stores selling groceries as Safeway had. Many other corporations that once dominated their fields have likewise fallen behind in the face of changes, or have even gone bankrupt. Pan American Airways, which pioneered in commercial flights across the Atlantic and the Pacific in the first half of the 20th century, went out of business in the late 20th century as a result of increased competition among airlines in the wake of the deregulation of the airline industry. Famous newspapers like the New York Herald Tribune, with a pedigree going back more than a century, stopped publishing in a new environment after television became a major source of news and newspaper unions made publishing more costly. Between 1949 and 1990, the total number of copies of all the newspapers sold daily in New York City fell from more than 6 million copies to less than 3 million. New York was not unique. Nationwide, daily newspaper circulation per capita dropped 44% between 1947 and 1998. The Herald Tribune was one of many local newspapers across the country to go out of business with the rise of television. The New York Daily Mirror, with a circulation of more than a million readers in 1949, went out of business in 1963. By 2004, the only American newspapers with daily circulations of a million or more were newspapers sold nationwide: USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. Back in 1949, New York City alone had two local newspapers that each sold more than a million copies daily: the Daily Mirror at 1,020,879, and the Daily News at 2,254,644. The decline was still continuing in the 21st century, as newspaper circulation nationwide fell nearly an additional 4 million between 2000 and 2006. Other great industrial and commercial firms that have declined or become extinct are likewise a monument to the unrelenting pressures of competition. So is the rising prosperity of the consuming public. The fate of particular companies or industries is not what is most important. Consumers are the principal beneficiaries of lower prices made possible by the more efficient allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. The key roles in all of this are played not only by prices and profits, but also by losses. These losses force businesses to change with changing conditions, or find themselves losing out to competitors who spot the new trends sooner, or who understand their implications better and respond faster. Knowledge is one of the scarcest of all resources in any economy, and the insight distilled from knowledge is even more scarce. An economy based on prices, profits, and losses gives decisive advantages to those with greater knowledge and insight. Put differently, knowledge and insight can guide the allocation of resources, even if most people, including the country's political leaders, do not share that knowledge or do not have the insight to understand what is happening. Clearly, this is not true in the kind of economic system where political leaders control economic decisions, for then the necessarily limited knowledge and insights of those leaders become decisive barriers to the progress of the whole economy. Even when leaders have more knowledge and insight than the average member of the society, they are unlikely to have nearly as much knowledge and insight as exists scattered among the millions of people subject to their governance. Knowledge and insight need not be technological or scientific for it to be economically valuable and decisive for the material well-being of the society as a whole. Something as mundane as retailing changed radically during the course of the 20th century, revolutionizing both department stores and grocery stores, and raising the standard of living of millions of people by lowering the costs of delivering goods to them. Individual businesses are forced to make drastic changes internally over time in order to survive. For example, names like Sears and Ward's came to mean department store chains to most Americans by the late 20th century. However, neither of these enterprises began as department store chains. Montgomery Ward, the original name of Ward's Department Stores, began as a mail-order house in the 19th century. Under the conditions of that time, before there were automobiles or trucks, and with most Americans living in small, rural communities, the high costs of delivering consumer goods to small and widely scattered local stores was reflected in the prices that were charged. These prices, in turn, meant that ordinary people could seldom afford many of the things that we today regard as basic. Montgomery Ward cut delivery costs by operating as a mail-order house, selling directly to consumers all over the country from its huge warehouse in Chicago. Using the existing railway freight shipping services, and later the post office, allowed Montgomery Ward to deliver its products to customers at lower costs that were reflected in lower prices than those charged by local stores in rural areas. Under these conditions, Montgomery Ward became the world's largest retailer in the late 19th century. During that same era, a young railroad agent named Richard Sears began selling watches on the side and ended up creating a rival mail order house that grew over the years to eventually become several times the size of Montgomery Ward. Moreover, the Sears retail empire outlasted the demise of its rival in 2001, when the latter closed its doors for the last time under its more recent name, Ward's Department Stores. One indication of the size of these two retail giants in their heyday as mail order houses was that each had railroad tracks running through its Chicago warehouse. That was one of the ways they cut delivery costs, allowing them to charge lower prices than those charged by local retail stores in what was still a predominantly rural country in the early 20th century. In 1903, the Chicago Daily Tribune reported that mail order houses were driving rural stores out of business. More important than the fates of these two businesses was the fact that millions of people were able to afford a higher standard of living than if they had to be supplied with goods through costlier channels. Meanwhile, there were changes over the years in American society, with more and more people beginning to live in urban communities. This was not a secret, but not everyone noticed such gradual changes, and even fewer had the insight to understand their implications for retail selling. It was 1920 before the census showed that, for the first time in the country's history, there were more Americans living in urban areas than in rural areas. One man who liked to pore over such statistics was Robert Wood, an executive at Montgomery Ward. Now, he realized, selling merchandise through a chain of urban department stores would be more efficient and more profitable than selling exclusively by mail order. Not only were his insights not shared by the head of Montgomery Ward, Wood was fired for trying to change company policy. Meanwhile, a man named James Cash Penny had the same insight and was already setting up his own chain of department stores. From very modest beginnings, the J.C. Penney chain grew to almost 300 stores by 1920 and more than 1,000 by the end of the decade. Their greater efficiency in delivering goods to urban consumers was a boon to those consumers, and Penney's competition became a big economic problem for the mail-order giants Sears and Montgomery Ward, both of which began losing money as department stores began taking customers away from mail-order houses. The fired Robert Wood went to work for Sears and was more successful there in convincing their top management to begin building department stores of their own. After they did, Montgomery Ward had no choice but to do the same belatedly, though it was never able to catch up to Sears again. Rather than get lost in the details of the histories of particular businesses, we need to look at this from the standpoint of the economy as a whole and the standard of living of the people as a whole. One of the biggest advantages of an economy coordinated by prices and operating under the incentives created by profit and loss is that it can tap scarce knowledge and insights, even when most of the people, or even their intellectual and political elites, do not have such knowledge or insights. The competitive advantages of those who are right can overwhelm the numerical or even financial advantages of those who are wrong. James Cash Penny did not start with a lot of money. He was, in fact, raised in poverty and began his retail career as just a one-third partner in a store in a little town in Wyoming at a time when Sears and Montgomery Ward were unchallenged giants of nationwide retailing. Yet his insights into the changing conditions of retailing eventually forced these giants into doing things his way, on pain of extinction. In a later era, a clerk in a JCPenney store named Sam Walton would learn retailing from the ground up, and then put his knowledge and insights to work in his own store, which would eventually expand to become the Walmart chain, with sales larger than those of Sears and JCPenney combined. One of the great handicaps of economies run by political authorities, whether under medieval mercantilism or modern communism, is that insights which arise among the masses have no such powerful leverage as to force those in authority to change the way they do things. Under any form of economic or political system, those at the top tend to become complacent, if not arrogant. Convincing them of anything is not easy, especially when it is some new way of doing things that is very different from what they are used to. The big advantage of a free market is that you don't have to convince anybody of anything. You simply compete with them in the marketplace, and let that be the test of what works best. Imagine a system in which James Cash Penny had to verbally convince the heads of Sears and Montgomery Ward to expand beyond mail-order retailing and build a nationwide chain of stores. Their response might well have been, "Who is this guy Penny, a part owner of some little store in a hick town nobody ever heard of, to tell us how to run the largest retail companies in the world?" In a market economy, Penny did not have to convince anybody of anything. All he had to do was deliver the merchandise to the consumers at lower prices. His success, and the millions of dollars in losses suffered by Sears and Montgomery Ward as a result, left these corporate giants no choice but to imitate this upstart in order to become profitable again. Although J.C. Penney grew up in worse poverty than most people who are on welfare today, his ideas and insights prevailed against some of the richest men of his time, who eventually realized that they would not remain rich much longer if Penny and others kept taking away their customers, leaving their companies with millions of dollars in losses each year. Economic changes. Economic changes include not only changes in the economy, but also changes within the managements of firms, especially in their responses to external economic changes. Many things that we take for granted today as features of a modern economy were resisted when first proposed and had to fight uphill to establish themselves by the power of the marketplace. Even something as widely used today as bank credit cards were initially resisted. When Bank AmeriCard and MasterCharge, later MasterCard, first appeared in the 1960s, leading New York department stores such as Macy's and Bloomingdale's said that they had no intention of accepting bank credit cards as payments for purchases in their stores, even though there were already millions of people with such cards in the New York metropolitan area. Only after the success of these credit cards in smaller stores did the big department stores finally relent and begin accepting credit cards. In 2003, for the first time, more purchases were made by credit cards or debit cards than by cash. That same year, Fortune magazine reported that a number of companies made more money from their own credit card business, with its interest charges, than from selling goods and services. Sears made more than half its profits from its credit cards, and Circuit City made all of its profits from its credit cards, while losing $17 million on its sales of electronic merchandise. Neither individuals nor companies are successful forever. Death alone guarantees turnover in management. Given the importance of the human factor and the variability among people, or even with the same person at different stages of life, it can hardly be surprising that dramatic changes over time in the relative positions of businesses have been the norm. Some individual executives are very successful during one era in the country's evolution, or during one period in their own lives, and very ineffective at a later time. Sewell Avery, for example, was for many years during the 20th century a highly successful and widely praised leader of U.S. Gypsum and later of Montgomery Ward. Yet his last years were marked by public criticism and controversy over the way he ran Montgomery Ward, and by a bitter fight for control of the company that he was regarded as mismanaging. When Avery resigned as chief executive officer, the value of Montgomery Ward's stock rose immediately. Under his leadership, Montgomery Ward had put aside so many millions of dollars as a cushion against an economic downturn that Fortune magazine called it a bank with a storefront. Meanwhile, rivals like Sears were using their money to expand into new markets. What is important is not the success or failure of particular individuals or companies, but the success of particular knowledge and insights in prevailing despite the blindness or resistance of particular business owners and managers. Given the scarcity of mental resources, an economy in which knowledge and insights have such decisive advantages in the competition of the marketplace is an economy which itself has great advantages in creating a higher standard of living for the population at large. A society in which only members of a hereditary aristocracy, a military junta, or a ruling political party can make major decisions is a society which has thrown away much of the knowledge, insights, and talents of most of its own people. A society in which such decisions can only be made by males has thrown away half of its knowledge, talents, and insights. Contrast societies with such restricted sources of decision-making ability with a society in which a farm boy who walked 8 miles to Detroit to look for a job could end up creating the Ford Motor Company and changing the face of America with mass-produced automobiles, or a society in which a couple of young bicycle mechanics could invent the airplane and change the whole world. Neither a lack of pedigree, nor a lack of academic degrees, nor even a lack of money could stop ideas that worked. For investment money is always looking for a winner to back and cash in on. A society which can tap all kinds of talents from all segments of its population has obvious advantages over societies in which only the talents of a pre-selected few are allowed to determine its destiny. No economic system can depend on the continuing wisdom of its current leaders. A price-coordinated economy with competition in the marketplace does not have to, because those leaders can be forced to change course, or be replaced, whether because of red ink, irate stockholders, outside investors ready to move in and take over, or because of bankruptcy. Given such economic pressures, it is hardly surprising that economies under the thumbs of kings or commissars have seldom matched the track record of economies based on competition and prices. Technological changes. For decades during the 20th century, television sets were built around a cathode ray tube, in which an image was projected from the small back end of the tube to the larger front screen where the picture was viewed. But a new century saw this technology replaced by new technologies that produced a thinner and flatter screen with sharper images. By 2006, only 21% of the television sets sold in the United States had picture tube technology, while 49% of all television sets sold had liquid crystal display, LCD screens, and another 10% had plasma screens. For more than a century, Eastman Kodak Company was the largest photographic company in the world. In 1976, Kodak sold 90% of all the film sold in the United States and 85% of all the cameras. But new technology created new competitors. At the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, digital cameras began to be produced, not only by such traditional manufacturers of cameras for film as Nikon, Canon, and Minolta, but also by producers of other computerized products such as Sony and Samsung. Moreover, smartphones could now take pictures, providing easy substitutes for the kinds of small, simple, and inexpensive cameras that Kodak manufactured. Film sales began falling for the first time after 2000, and digital camera sales surpassed the sales of film cameras for the first time 3 years later. This sudden change left Kodak scrambling to convert from film photography to digital photography, while companies specializing in digital photography took away Kodak's customers. The ultimate irony in all this was that the digital camera was invented by Kodak, but apparently other companies saw its potential earlier and developed the technology better. By the third quarter of 2011, Eastman Kodak reported a $222 million loss, its ninth quarterly loss in 3 years. Both the price of its stock and the number of its employees fell to less than one-tenth of what they had once been. In January 2012, Eastman Kodak filed for bankruptcy. Meanwhile, its biggest competitor in the business, the Japanese firm Fuji, which produced both film and cameras, diversified into other fields, including cosmetics and flat-screen television. Similar technological revolutions have occurred in other industries and in other times. Clocks and watches for centuries depended on springs and gears to keep time and move the hour and minute hands. The Swiss became renowned for the high quality of the internal watch mechanisms they produced, and the leading American watch company in the mid-20th century, Bulova, used mechanisms made in Switzerland for its best-selling watches. However, the appearance of quartz timekeeping technology in the early 1970s, which was more accurate and had lower costs, led to a dramatic fall in the sales of Bulova watches and vanishing profits for the company that made them. As the Wall Street Journal reported, for 1975, the firm reported a $21 million loss on $55 million in sales. That year, the company was reported to have 8% of domestic U.S. watch sales, one-tenth of what it claimed at its zenith in the early 1960s. Changes in business leadership. Perhaps the most overlooked fact about industry and commerce is that they are run by people who differ greatly from one another in insight, foresight, leadership, organizational ability, and dedication, just as people do in every other walk of life. Therefore, the companies they lead likewise differ in the efficiency with which they perform their work. Moreover, these differences change over time. The automobile industry is just one example. According to Forbes Business Magazine in 2003, other automakers can't come close to Toyota on how much it costs to build cars, and this shows up on the bottom line. Toyota earned $1,800 for every vehicle sold, GM made $300, and Ford lost $240, Forbes reported. Toyota makes a net profit far bigger than the combined total for Detroit's Big Three, according to The Economist magazine in 2005. But by 2010, Detroit's Big Three automakers were earning more profits per vehicle than the average of Toyota and Honda. By 2012, the Ford Motor Company's annual profit was $5.7 billion, while General Motors earned $4.9 billion and Toyota earned $3.45 billion. Toyota's lead in the quality of its cars was likewise not permanent. Business Week in 2003 reported that although Toyota spent fewer hours manufacturing each automobile, its cars had fewer defects than those of any of the American Big Three automakers. High rankings for quality by Consumer Reports magazine during the 1970s and 1980s have been credited with helping Toyota's automobiles gain widespread acceptance in the American market, and though Honda and Subaru overtook Toyota in the Consumer Reports rankings in 2007, Toyota continued to outrank any American automobile manufacturer in quality at that time. Over the years, however, competition from Japanese automakers brought marked improvements in American-made cars, closing the quality gap with Asian automakers, according to the Wall Street Journal. However, in 2012, Consumer Reports reported that a perfect storm of reliability problems dropped the Ford Motor Company out of the top 10, while Toyota swept the top spots. Although Toyota surpassed General Motors as the world's largest automobile manufacturer, in 2010, it had to stop production and recall more than 8 million cars because of problems with their acceleration. Neither quality leadership nor any other kind of leadership is permanent in a market economy. What matters far more than the fate of any given business is how much its efficiency can benefit consumers. As Business Week said of the Walmart retail chain, at Walmart, everyday low prices is more than a slogan. It is the fundamental tenet of a cult masquerading as a company. New England Consulting estimates that Walmart saved its U.S. customers $20 billion last year alone. Business leadership is a factor, not only in the relative success of various enterprises, but more fundamentally in the advance of the economy as a whole, through the spread of the impact of new and better business methods to competing companies and other industries. While the motives for these improvements are the bottom lines of the companies involved, the bottom line for the economy as a whole is the standard of living of the people who buy the products and services that these companies produce. Although we measure the amount of petroleum in barrels, which is how it was once shipped in the 19th century, today it is actually shipped in railroad tank cars, or tanker trucks on land, or in gigantic oil tankers at sea. The most famous fortune in American history, that of John D. Rockefeller, was made by revolutionizing the way oil was refined and distributed, drastically lowering the cost of delivering its various finished products to the consumer. When Rockefeller entered the oil business in the 1860s, there were no automobiles, so the principal use of petroleum was to produce kerosene for lamps, since there were no electric lights then either. When petroleum was refined to produce kerosene, the gasoline that was a byproduct was so little valued that some oil companies simply poured it into a river to get rid of it. In an industry where many investors and businesses went bankrupt, Rockefeller made the world's largest fortune by revolutionizing the industry. Shipping his oil in railroad tank cars, rather than in barrels like his competitors, was just one of the cost-saving innovations that made Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company the biggest and most profitable enterprise in the petroleum industry. He also hired scientists to create numerous new products from petroleum, ranging from paints to paraffin to anesthetics to Vaseline. And they used gasoline for fuel in the production process instead of letting it go to waste. Kerosene was still the principal product of petroleum, but because Standard Oil did not have to recover all its production costs from the sale of kerosene, it was able to sell the kerosene more cheaply. The net result, from a business standpoint, was that Standard Oil ended up selling about 90% of the kerosene in the country. From the standpoint of the consumers, the results were even more striking. Kerosene was literally the difference between light and darkness for most people at night. As the price of kerosene fell from 58 cents a gallon in 1865 to 26 cents a gallon in 1870, and then to 8 cents a gallon during the 1870s, far more people were able to have light after sundown. As a distinguished historian put it, before 1870, only the rich could afford whale oil and candles. The rest had to go to bed early to save money. By the 1870s, with the drop in the price of kerosene, middle and working class people all over the nation could afford the 1 cent an hour that it cost to light their homes at night. Working and reading became after dark activities new to most Americans in the 1870s. The later rise of the automobile created a vast new market for gasoline, just as Standard Oil's more efficient production of petroleum products facilitated the growth of the automobile industry. It is not always one individual who is the key to the success of a given business, as Rockefeller was to the success of Standard Oil. What is really key is the role of knowledge and insights in the economy, whether they are concentrated in one individual or more widely dispersed. Some business leaders are very good at some aspects of management and very weak in other aspects. The success of the business then depends on which aspects happen to be crucial at a particular time. Sometimes two executives with very different skills and weaknesses combine to produce a very successful management team, whereas either one of them might have failed completely if operating alone. Ray Kroc, founder of the McDonald's chain, was a genius at operating details and may well have known more about hamburgers, milkshakes, and French fries than any other human being, and there was a lot to know, but he was out of his depth in complex financial operations. These matters were handled by Harry Sonneborn, who was a financial genius whose improvisations rescued the company from the brink of bankruptcy more than once during its rocky early years. But Sonneborn didn't even eat hamburgers, much less have any interest in how they were made or marketed. However, as a team, Kroc and Sonneborn made McDonald's one of the leading corporations in the world. When an industry or a sector of the economy is undergoing rapid change through new ways of doing business, sometimes the leaders of the past find it hardest to break the mold of their previous experience. For example, when the fast food revolution burst forth in the 1950s, existing leaders and restaurant franchises such as Howard Johnson were very unsuccessful in trying to compete with upstarts like McDonald's in the fast food segment of the market. Even when Howard Johnson set up imitations of the new fast food restaurants under the name Howard Johnson Jr., these imitations were unable to compete successfully because they carried over into the fast food business approaches and practices that were successful in conventional restaurants, but which slowed down operations too much to be successful in the new fast food sector, where rapid turnover with inexpensive food was the key to profits. Selecting managers can be as chancy as any other aspect of a business. Only by trial and error did the new McDonald's franchise chain discover back in the 1950s what kinds of people were most successful at running their restaurants. The first few franchisees were people with business experience, who nevertheless did very poorly. The first two really successful McDonald's franchisees, who were very successful, were a working-class married couple who drained their life savings in order to go into business for themselves. They were so financially strained at the beginning that they even had trouble coming up with the $100 needed to put into the cash register on their opening day so as to be able to make change, but they ended up millionaires. Other working-class people who put everything they owned on the line to open a McDonald's restaurant also succeeded on a grand scale, even when they had no experience in running a restaurant or managing a business. When McDonald's set up its own company-owned restaurants, these restaurants did not succeed nearly as well as restaurants owned by people whose life savings were at stake, but there was no way to know that in advance. The importance of the personal factor in the performance of corporate management was suggested in another way by a study of chief executive officers in Denmark. A death in the family of a Danish CEO led, on average, to a 9% decline in the profitability of the corporation. If it was the death of a spouse, the decline was 15%, and if it was a child who died, 21%. According to the Wall Street Journal, the drop was sharper when the child was under 18, and greater still if it was the death of an only child. Although corporations are often spoke of as impersonal institutions operating in an impersonal market, both the market and the corporations reflect the personal priorities and performances of people. Market economies must rely not only on price competition between various producers to allow the most successful to continue and expand, they must also find some way to weed out those business owners or managers who do not get the most from the nation's resources. Losses accomplish that. Bankruptcy shuts down the entire enterprise that is consistently failing to come up to the standards of its competitors, or is producing a product that has been superseded by some other product. Before reaching that point, however, losses can force a firm to make internal reassessments of its policies and personnel. These include the chief executive, who can be replaced by irate stockholders who are not receiving the dividends they expected. A poorly managed company is more valuable to outside investors than to its existing owners when these outside investors are convinced that they can improve its performance. Outside investors can therefore offer existing stockholders more for their stock than it is currently worth and still make a profit if that stock's value later rises to the level expected when existing management is replaced by more efficient managers. For example, if the stock is selling in the market for $50 a share under inefficient management, outside investors can start buying it up at $60 a share until they own a controlling interest in the corporation. After using that control to fire existing managers and replace them with a more efficient management team, the value of the stock may then rise to $100 a share. While this profit is what motivates the investors, from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, what matters is that such a rise in stock prices usually means that either the business is now serving more customers or offering them better quality or lower prices, or is operating at lower cost, or some combination of these things. Like so many other things, running a business looks easy from the outside. On the eve of the Bolshevik Revolution, the leader of the communist movement, V.I. Lenin, declared that accounting and control were the key factors in running an enterprise, and that capitalism had already reduced the administration of businesses to extraordinarily simple operations that any literate person can perform, that is, supervising and recording, knowledge of the four rules of arithmetic, and issuing appropriate receipts. Such exceedingly simple operations of registration, filing, and checking could, according to Lennon, easily be performed by people receiving ordinary workmen's wages. After just a few years in power as ruler of the Soviet Union, however, Lenin confronted a very different and very bitter reality. He himself wrote of a fuel crisis which threatens to disrupt all Soviet work, of economic ruin, starvation, and devastation in the country, and even admitted that peasant uprisings had become a common occurrence under communist rule. In short, the economic functions, which had seemed so easy and simple before having to perform them, now seemed almost overwhelmingly difficult. Relatedly, Lenin saw a need for people who are versed in the art of administration and admitted that there is nowhere we can turn for such people except the old class, that is, the capitalist businessmen. In his address to the 1920 Communist Party Congress, Lenin warned his comrades, "Opinions on corporate management are all too frequently imbued with a spirit of sheer ignorance, an anti-expert spirit." The apparent simplicities of just 3 years earlier now required experts. Thus began Lenin's new economic policy, which allowed more market activity and under which the economy began to revive. Nearly 100 years later, with the Russian economy growing at less than 2% annually, the same lesson was learned anew by another Russian leader. A front-page story in the New York Times in 2013 reported how, with the Russian economy languishing, President Vladimir V. Putin has devised a plan for turning things around. Offer amnesty to some of the imprisoned business people.